Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I always say I watch movies about marriage, and I'm like, ooh, yes, reminds me of Dan, you know.
You know. Like, what movie reminds you of your relationship?
Yes, Scenes from a Marriage. No, I haven't seen that, actually.
A Marriage Story?
A Marriage Story, yeah.
Am I Adam Driver? Are you?
No, you're Scarlett Johansson. Okay, I'm the hero that the audience likes.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Daniels are a filmmaker duo made up of, yes, two men named Daniel, Daniel Scheinert and Daniel Kwan, who also goes by Dan. They are the writers and directors of the movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, a very strange and moving film about the metaverse and generational trauma that also may be the first award season darling that has not one, but a few dildo gags. The story follows Evelyn Wang, played by Michelle Yeoh, as she tries to save the world while being audited by an IRS agent, played by Jamie Lee Curtis.
With nothing but a stack of receipts, I can trace the ups and downs of your lives. And it does not look good. It does not look good.
Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert are both in their 30s. Kwan is 34, Scheinert is 35, and they've been working together since they were film students in their early 20s. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once has been a massive hit. And as we started our conversation, it seemed like they're still getting used to the crush of attention that it's brought the two of them. I know you all have done a lot of interviews together, but, you know, don't feel like you have to wait for me to turn the question to the other. Like, please feel free to just kind of add on.
You're
going to
regret that.
Oh,
because we talk way too much.
Yeah, we have the opposite problem. You're going to be like, you already answered the question. You don't have to.
Stop talking.
Why are both Daniels just going back and forth?
But thank you for the invitation.
Yeah.
Just talking with the Daniels, you immediately feel the way they collaborate. And I wanted to know more about this relationship, how it started and how it's developed. Dan Kwan grew up in Massachusetts. His parents met in Syracuse after immigrating from Hong Kong and Taipei. Daniel Scheinert is white, from Alabama, back several generations. Somehow, together, their taste and sense of humor combine to take their audiences to some very far-out places. Like, for instance...
She appears to be in a universe where everyone has hot dogs instead of fingers.
I mean, it just doesn't matter.
The first question I have for you is, whose idea was hot dogs for fingers?
I think it's Dan Kwan.
I don't know. I think usually what happens is I say things that I shouldn't say, and then before I can take it back, Scheinert says, yes, that's good. Let's keep going with that.
Yeah, and we also, like, have been doing, like, weird body horror comedy shorts for, like, 12 years. And so like,
yeah, a long time.
You can basically like pick any body part, and we've made jokes about it in the past. But I do remember you pitching that to me and me being not convinced.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't have been.
I was like, huh, well, we'll hold on to that idea. We'll see. I don't know if I want to ask, you know, famous actresses I admire to do that. But look at us now.
Daniel Scheinert and Dan Kwan first met in film school at Emerson College in Boston during the late 2000s. Scheinert was a year ahead of Kwan, and they had different creative ambitions and anxieties.
I went to film school and pretty quickly realized I wasn't director material. I was like, I don't think I'm cut out for this. I don't have leadership qualities. I don't have the confidence. I don't want to make other people work on my ideas. It didn't feel right to me, and I was very uncomfortable with that.
Did you, when you were discovering that about yourself, Dan, did that feel like a failure, like something you were ashamed of, or something you just were clear kind of learning about yourself?
Oh, I mean, that's such a great question, because at the time, I don't think I could have put into words what I was feeling, but I think shame is sort of my default mode. I'm working on it now, but especially back then, a lot of everything was framed through shame. So, of course, that was definitely framed through that as well. But also, you know, because that was my default mode, I'm very flexible, where I'm like, okay, you know what? This sucks, but I'll pivot again, as I always do. And so I thought I went into animation, because I was like, okay, this is a way for me to create without having to feel all those burdens of directing that I didn't feel right for. And then that's when I met Scheinert. We met in an animation class, and you know, in a lot of ways, I owe a lot to Scheinert, because he's the opposite.
Just confident as hell, confident to a fault. I mean, especially in film school, I think I had the attitude of like, I'm going to get my money's worth. Like, I was like, holy crap, film school costs too much. And I was constantly doing the math in my head of like how, like a 2-hour class, how like that's hundreds of dollars. And like, if the teacher would play a movie in class, I'd be like, this is absurd. I paid $200 so that Emerson College could show me Cloverfield. I've already seen Cloverfield. So I was that kind of asshole.
Did you like, did you think you were going to be friends? Like, do you have... It sounds like you have slightly different personalities or ways of presenting socially. Is that right?
Yeah, we had creativity crushes, but not friend like material vibes. we were like very different. And then we did become friends after I had graduated. I had a summer job at this summer camp that teaches filmmaking to like middle and high schoolers. And our job as film students was just supervise the kids while they make their movies.
It was the best job ever. To this day,
we got paid like $20 an hour just to like hang out with kids while they make their movies. And so then I got Dan a job, cause we had hung out a bit. And then I remember like our first day working together at that camp, we kind of like, suddenly we were like, wait, we actually have a lot in common, cause we both, we're just kind of like have camp counselor vibes, and we were encouraging our kids to make increasingly insane short films. I think, was it the first day that I almost, that was the same day that I almost got you fired?
No.
I almost got fired.
You almost got yourself fired. And yeah. You almost got all your kids sent home.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
I was teaching them about long lenses and wide angle lenses, you know? That was the assignment. And I was like, long lenses are great for hidden camera stuff like Jackass because you can hide in the bushes with a long lens and no one can see the camera. So why don't we do that? And then my kids ran off and they told me they had just gotten some lettuce. And they
some
were gonna,
salad.
They were going to throw a salad on somebody while hiding in the bushes. And I was like, well, don't throw it on a student. Throw it on my friend Dan. But I didn't know they had filled the salad with
like beans,
soda,
meat,
beans,
soda, cheese,
salad dressing. Like it was gross.
And then somehow the soda actually digested some of the food. So it actually was putrid.
It kind of like, had vomit vibes.
Exactly.
He was like, did you just throw vomit on me?
Yeah, it was really confusing.
And so then my kids got taken to the like camp heads and threatened to get kicked out. And I took the fall for it because it really was my fault. And I went and explained
it. Yeah, you were the adult.
I was literally, my job is to supervise. And I was there like being like, hey, why don't you throw things at adults? They just said, don't let it happen again, Daniel. And luckily, I got to stay.
But it was a very clarifying moment, because I do think now looking back on it, it was actually really informative for our process. Growing up, I was really active in the church. And every single summer, there was this thing called VBS,
Vacation
Bible
School.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are familiar. And, you know, From a pretty young age, I was very active in being a part of that energy, just, you know, starting the morning warm-ups and doing the songs with everyone. And basically, I became like my church's MC or whatever. And looking back on it now, I see
you do have leadership qualities, Dan Kwan.
Exactly. But so, like, I didn't realize that at the time. Yeah.
And like a classroom, Dan's so shy. And then like it's so weird. It was so weird to see that switch turn and be like, holy cow. Like he's like, you know, really controlling the group and the energy and the vibes once this kind of
This is something that like me and Shiner discovered slowly over the past, you know, 12 years is that as directors, we work much better, less as like dictators or, you know, the boss of the company. And when we switch over to camp counselor energy, it's way more effective, way more fun, and it just plays to our strengths.
So they each liked a particular kind of community building, and they brought this to their work, even as their work styles and social instincts were very different. They considered this a matter of personality, until just a few years ago, when Dan Kwan realized his brain works differently, because he has ADHD.
It was about 5 or 6 years ago, and the funny story is that we were writing this movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once, and we thought that the main character was going to be incredibly distractible. We wanted this film to be about how impossible it is to live in the current age without being distracted, without being present. Yeah. And so we thought, oh, maybe the main character could have ADHD. And that's why she's able to jump between different universes. And we were like, well, we should probably do some research. We don't want to, you know, portray this in the wrong way. And then that night I was up until like 4 a.m. just researching on my phone and basically taking all the unofficial quizzes, like, do you have ADHD? All that stuff. And just crying because I was, It was this beautiful moment where I realized why my life had been so hard for so long, and also why I think I have so much shame. And one of the things that we talk about often within the ADHD community is how our motivation structures within our minds aren't working properly. And so we're constantly having to chase the dopamine, right? You're trying to ride that wave, looking for the thing that will keep you motivated, keep you engaged, not just with the activity you're doing, but with life in general. And so that was that diagnosis has been just huge for me as far as my self-esteem and my self-image and understanding, how to move through this world. And so, yeah, this movie, was a kind of saved my life a little bit.
You were doing character research and then landed on something that felt true
exactly.
for you.
Yeah.
And one more question about this. When you described chasing the dopamine hits, for you, is that related to chasing novelty? Like, does it have to be new?
Often, yes. It's novelty is definitely something that people with ADHD are chasing after. But for me, a lot of the dopamine chasing is about discovering new things. And so whenever we start a new script, I go and find all the books I can, and I listen to all the podcasts I can, and I write little essays, and I try to understand, first of all, why I'm so interested in it, but also how it can apply to our next script. And so there's that part of it, but then also the other half of it is like, what is fun? What is just pleasurable? There are very few things as fulfilling as finishing a film with a bunch of friends, you know? And so things like that keep us motivated and keep us excited. But then of course, we've also just built in a system of a lot of breaks from work, you know? Like oftentimes now when we write, we're just skateboarding in my back alleyway. And I think we're starting to embrace this this thing where work and play, the line is kind of fuzzier.
It's the two of you skateboarding in the alleyway?
Yeah, we're both so good.
No,
yeah.
I'm terrible.
The listeners should just picture us like doing kickflips and
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Kwan can almost do an ollie,
Just for context, though, like this is all a part of like my post-diagnosis life. Most of my life, I was so bad at everything because I was so distractible and I had no follow through. But I just, because of that, I was so afraid to start anything. So I just didn't, I just spent a decent chunk of my life not trying new things. Hmm. And now that I'm diagnosed and I understand that, I'm probably going to fall out of love with a new hobby or whatever, you know, just knowing that eventually my brain is going to be like, you know what, I don't care about this anymore. Going into it knowing that it's going to end, I'm able to just embrace it for what it is. And so I just started skating for the first time as an adult. So I'm in my mid-30s. And I just started doing it like a couple years ago. And I'm really bad at it. But like, it's that is growth, honestly. Me being okay with myself being bad at something is like, that's a new development for sure.
Finding these new ways of working together took some experimenting, because over the years, there have been some false starts, like when they were trying to finish their first feature film called Swiss Army Man, and they were really struggling.
It was the hardest thing we'd ever done, and we were having this argument about, like, I thought it was too hard. And I was like,
if you this... thought making this feature film was too hard. And
yeah.
It became not fun.
If every feature film is as hard as this, I don't want to do them anymore, was kind of my stance. And mm-hmm. Kwan was more like, we could do better. Let's make the next one better. I don't care if it's harder. We just have to do better, you know?
Yeah.
There was a bit of an impasse there. And we gave each other the space and grace to kind of to experiment with the process, to do both and, to try to make it better, but also try to make it behind the scenes better, not just on screen better.
Wait, how did you give each other that space and grace? Like, you said that in a jokey way, but like, that's hard if
yeah.
you have very different ideas about, sounds like.
I mean, one thing.
A lot of things, often it's just time.
Totally.
I think giving ourselves time to live and not be impatient. I know this industry needs to move so fast and wants you to move so fast. And I think one of the great things about both of us is neither of us, even though we love making films and that are successful, we're not chasing success. We're not chasing those things. We both have a very shared interest in just making things, the things that we want and the things that we think will reflect the world back to mm-hmm. itself. And so because of that, we have time to give each other the space and grace and
I mean,
to develop, you know.
It was funny, like, back to that night when Dan was up all night in bed. that week, we had been having some of the most intense disagreements about the edit on Swiss Army Man.
Oh,
we were,
right.
like, still editing.
Oh.
And we had decided, like, let's get drinks away from the computer and just talk about, you know,
process
and how we're doing. And so, like, I kind of came in like with like, okay, the things I want to complain about. And Dan sat down. I was like, hey, I think I'm a bad creative partner because I have ADHD and I'm undiagnosed. And it just like took the wind out of my sails. I was like, no way, man. What does that mean? And I do think that is one of 100 adjustments was just finding vocabulary for our process and being like, oh, this is like part of what makes Dan so creative and talented is also what makes him a little
difficult to work
unreliable,
with.
You know? It's like, oh, he's capable of hyper focus and a little less good at consistent focus. And
yes.
like, great, I'll take it. No notes. Like, but now we have a word for it that's less, you know, judgmental or angry. And it's just like, oh, this is hey man, this is happening. You know?
That's a very good example of active grace, which is, you know, I'm very appreciative of.
But also I'm appreciative that you did the work and figured it out. You know, like the self-reflection,
right.
you know, paid off for everybody.
Well, and that you got to like, you were, it wasn't a conflict that you were just having by proxy by fighting over edit notes. You instead like figured out you needed to step away from the computer and have a conversation.
Yeah,
totally.
Where you saw each other a little more clearly.
I think I made that pretty apparent. I was being a big baby. And it was very obvious that like it wasn't about the thing on camera. I was just like, but I think that is where my brain often goes is it's as it like telescopes out and goes like, there's something bigger here. The communication's
right.
bad.
Yeah.
It's not about the color of the paint. It's about the way you're talking about the color of the paint.
Yeah.
And when you're a big baby, what do you do? What did that look like?
I kept leaving the edit a lot. I would leave Dan and our editor alone. And then like, I just stormed out one night. I was like, good luck. I don't want to be here try stuff. I don't give a shit anymore. One way I pitched it to Dan, like one of the, I get butt hurt when he'll be hard on our movie and not acknowledge that it's my movie too. You know,
he'll it hurts your feelings.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So like he'll frame it and he'll think he's being self-deprecating, but our lives are so intertwined that it's like, no, you're being us deprecating.
Yeah.
And I'm standing over here. You know,
us deprecating.
Coming up, how the surprise success of their film Everything Everywhere All at Once is changing both Daniels in real time.
Yeah, we're still in the middle of so much of it. We could do part two interview next year and see if it went to our heads or if it drove us insane or
how many cards you have.
We'll set a date. We'll see then.
Hey, I want to turn away from this conversation about movie making in Hollywood for a minute to let you know about a loss I'm absorbing in my life, because I could use your help. Earlier this week, my family said goodbye to our nearly 14-year-old Australian Shepherd, Jack. He was truly a very sweet boy who was right there when I fell in love with Arthur, when we got married, when we first became parents, when we brought home our second baby. We moved a lot of places over those years, and he became home for us. So, figuring out how to love him as he declined and got more disoriented and more stressed has been really hard. The question of when and how to end his life was an existential and logistical puzzle that made me well up with tears whenever I considered it over these last months and weeks. And then I'd cry again when I thought about how to bring in our little kids to this experience. And now, having watched him die and noticing his absence make my eyes well up for different reasons, I miss him. I'm sad he's only a memory now. Anyway, it's made death feel very close and unavoidable. And I'd like to hear your stories of saying goodbye to cherished pets. How did you do it? How did you avoid going out and picking up a new puppy immediately? Because that's my current phase of grief. Tell us about saying goodbye to a pet you've loved. You can record a voice memo. Tell us your pet's names, how you think back on his or her end, and how you've carried that intimate exposure to death forward. And send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. I look forward to listening. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home. And you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. As Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert have been working together, they've also made film projects separately and have been building their own families. Kwan is a father of a young son and is married to animator Kirsten Lepore, who happened to work on Marcel the Shell, another of our team's favorite movies of 2022. Scheinert has been with his partner, Stephanie, a Planned Parenthood organizer he met in college, for more than a dozen years. But the two Daniels keep collaborating on film projects because of what their contrasting creative instincts spark together. One of them, Scheinert, can be more of the world-weary skeptic, while Kwan is all about possibility and wild ideas.
I love everything. I'm like, this is awesome. This is great.
And you're such
beautiful.
A pushover. You're like, nice to meet you. And I'm like, no, it's not. You're part of the problem. You know, like, I'm so reactionary sometimes.
But I think, you know, obviously you can unpack a lot of different reasons why we turned out this way. But it's a really...
You're a great therapist, by the way.
Am I?
No, I'm talking to her.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, I was like, I don't think I'm a good therapist.
No, yeah. Don't release this, but this has been very good for us.
I have, when you said butthurt, Daniel Scheinert, it made me think about, like, there's so much, this conversation has been so feelings forward, and you both are describing yourselves and each other with such awareness and self-awareness. And but when you said butthurt, it reminded me that you're also two dudes. And I
what,
wonder,
girls don't
like,
say butthurt?
I don't think as much. I think it's more like...
They say boob hurt.
Right. Yeah, okay. So there we go.
Do they?
But did you, whether through talking about your work and the kind of work you wanted to make or just talking about the ways you expect to be treated by one another and want to treat each other, like, have you had direct conversations about, like, masculinity, the kind of men you are?
Totally. But I do think we're, funnily enough, we're, like, kind of bad communicators about our personal lives. we communicate with each other through creative ideas.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's like while pitching, we're learning things about ourselves, you know?
Yeah. We never really set out to say, hey, let's do something about masculinity. Like growing up, most of my friendships that really clicked were actually with other, were with women, and I had a hard time fitting in most male activities, did not do well with sports teams, did not do well with a lot of that stuff. And anytime I tried to imitate it, it would feel really awful. And so I kind of pushed back against it. I got into the punk scene, the local emo punk scene, and there's much more of like a queer open space in the punk world where people can dress at however they want, and I found that really exciting and beautiful. And I started to dress different. Most people at my school, you know, they actually thought I was gay, and I wasn't gay, and that was also a whole nother thing. I was very confused, and I'm so grateful for all the queer thinkers and writers and activists who have decoupled sexuality and gender for us all, so that we have the language to understand ourselves better. Because, like, at the time, I remember the phrase metrosexual was getting passed around, and I was like, maybe that, am I metrosexual? Is that me? Uh-huh. And then, like, I tried it on for a week. I was like, hell no, that's not what, like, it's such a, obviously it's a problematic phrase now, but at the time it was like, ew, that's not what I'm talking about, but thanks for trying. And so, yeah, I wore a lot of girls' clothes, I you know, paint my nails. My mom was very, you know, being very traditional Chinese immigrant, was afraid that I was gay, and we grew up in the church. So it was a very complicated, strange thing that only now that I'm an adult and I have my own son, I'm starting to really feel comfortable with. But I'm really grateful, like, again, for the language that the queer community has provided straight men like me, because I do think that when the queer community is lifted up, it actively helps cis straight men. And right. I don't think people see that enough. It's like we are trapped in all these boxes and we're just afraid to open the doors to let it all mix together.
As I was watching Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, it's so much about the necessity of critique and honestly looking at pain and absurdity and suffering and misunderstandings. But there's also a moment pretty early in the film where there's conversation about the decline of community and institutions and durable relationships.
Our institutions are crumbling. Nobody trusts their neighbor anymore. And you stay up at night wondering to yourself,
how can we get back?
And the question is, how can we get back? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, like, do you think of those questions as related, that on the one hand, you're interested in, like, blowing up labels, and on the other hand, you're like, what else is there, that how do we maintain some kind of connective tissue?
Oh, my God. There's so much to unpack in this.
Yeah. I mean, we always kind of made fun of that speech as, like, our version of a MAGA speech, you know? Just like,
oh, interesting.
This is the guy who's like, we got to get our institutions back or whatever. And I think we kind of made fun of it a bit, but tried to articulate the part of it that's somewhat relatable, that is, like, understandable, that, like, our parents' generation is scared of change. And ultimately, I do think the whole movie was kind of like an exercise in us, you know, not just being the, like, label-exploding, screaming millennials, but trying to connect with and learn from the generation that came before us and empathize with, you know, the good parts of, you know, the society that came before us, but also, like, empathize with just how hard and beautiful but challenging it is to change your mind or to adjust or to move in new directions, you know?
There's one more quote I want to throw out there, but I don't remember who it's from, and I'm so sorry. But
probably me.
Yeah, it's you. Exactly. You're a genius. I'm gonna quote you right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to paraphrase, but they basically said, like, society as a whole, we all need to believe that there is stability. But the artist's job is to remind himself or herself or themselves and the world that nothing in this world is stable. We can do better. We can be better. In order to get there, we might have to, you know, break some eggs and feel some pain. And I think that's Yeah, I think that's where we're at right now. I think we're all feeling a lot of pain.
I think that's a James Baldwin quote. I just looked it up.
Yes, thank you. James Baldwin, genius.
A society must assume that it is stable, but the artist must know, and he must let us know, that there is nothing stable under heaven.
Thank you. I love that you just could look that up.
Yeah, he said
thank
it better.
Thank you, technology. Exactly.
And how does that sit with you as a parent, Dan? That idea of, like, stability being a mirage.
Yeah, that's a beautiful and horrifying question. Parenting has been just the hardest thing and the most, like, life-changing, paradigm-shifting thing for me. And that's been really good for me. But one thing that I'm realizing now, looking back at my own childhood and looking at my son now, who is almost four, is that one of the best gifts you can give to a child is, I don't want to say the illusion of stability, but this magic trick where you manifest stability in a chaotic world. If you can give them that safe launching pad, they will be so resilient and emotionally intelligent and capable of becoming stable for someone else, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, at no fault to my parents, you know, they did the best with what they could. I grew up and I've become a very unstable human being. And I look at people like Daniel and realize the reason why I am drawn to them and I need them in my life is because they grew up in households that gave them that stability. And so it's not, I'll say stability is not impossible, but it's also not a given. And in fact, it has to be. It's something that has to be protected and fought for. And so as a parent, this is what I'm thinking about. And I'm doing a terrible job sometimes with my son. It's like so hard to break free from these things. And so anyways, I'm really grateful for the people around me who give me an example of what a confident, stable existence can look like. And I want to be able to pay that forward to the people around me.
And Daniel Scheinert, is the way Dan described you, does that feel accurate inside yourself? Like, do you feel that sense of kind of like stable footing?
I think sometimes, you know, making a project that's all about reflecting on these generation gaps has definitely kind of made me reflect on like some of the like extremely lucky things I got out of, you know, my relationship with my family and what I learned from the generations before me. Only now as an adult am I kind of hearing like these stories about like what my dad's childhood was like. I'm learning that like his childhood was pretty bonkers and he was a completely different parent to me than my granddad was to him. And like seeing like just how huge of a deal that is to be like, holy cow, that's not an easy thing to do to choose to be like, no, I'm going to be this kind of parent. And he like put his career was like kind of his second priority, maybe third, you know, like he had kids and was like, no, I'm going to be a dad. Took like a 3-year sabbatical to just be a dad for a while. He like, I don't want to shit talk my granddad. He was great. I grew up loving him. But like now I'm just hearing these stories and being like, oh, wow, like my childhood was different.
He parented in a very different way.
Uh-huh. Especially in the 90s. Every 90s movie was about how dads were never there. never at home.
And I'm from the South. Like, right. I'm like a third or fourth generation redneck. And like on both sides, it goes back into like some really desperate, impoverished times. And like, yeah, some really epic cycles got broken. And I'm so lucky.
You mentioned earlier that when you talked about what your hopes are for the things you make together, that financial success or success at the box office hasn't been the thing that you've articulated as your mission. Like, what is it? What is it? How have you committed to each other about what you're trying to do with what you're making?
I have this spiel I sometimes go on that, like, you know, as a young person, certain filmmakers inspired me. But then I would realize, like, some of them only make one good movie. And I was like, or they burn out and they disappear. And I was like, well, then that doesn't seem like a career that I want. I actually want to have a career. And And so then I was like, oh, who makes lots of good things? Those are the people I should look up to. And then you started hearing that a lot of filmmakers are assholes. And I was like, okay, who has a whole career making lots of movies and they're not mean?
And they're good family people.
And then I realized even those people are like absentee parents. And like Dan and I love like kids and like being parents has always been super important to both of us. So then we were like, okay, what we're looking for is a sustained career where we're not mean, the content's pretty good, and we're also not absentee terrible partners and parents. You know, like we're scared of burning out. We're scared of being turning into people we don't admire or want to be more than we're focused on the money, the awards, the celebrities, you know. But like right now, we're getting all of it.
I know. That's the wild thing.
Except we're becoming assholes.
Yeah, exactly.
This has all been a front. Like, I think we're lucky that we weren't overnight successes, that we've had 12 years to kind of, like, find collaborators and find these people in our lives that kind of keep us in check. And we're going to need that in the coming months. I think there's definitely a part of us that, I mean, we definitely didn't expect to be talking, that the promotion tour this spring would just segue into more promotion and into award season. And that, like, I feel like right now we're becoming like these like public figures, you know, like doing things like this podcast and be like, this is barely even about the movie. This is just about us. Like, who cares? But
I care. It's been a really good conversation.
I think, but
thank you.
I've
learned a lot.
And
yeah,
I think
don't be us deprecating, okay? Well, she cares.
That was filmmakers Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. Their movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once is now available to stream. And there's also a link in our show notes to their first big breakthrough, the music video they directed for the song Turn Down for What. It's definitely worth a watch if you haven't ever seen it. And it includes some hot dance moves from Dan Kwan. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Afi Yellowduke and Andrew Dunn. The rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Zoe Azoulay, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. And special thanks to Lily Clark for her help with this episode and for taking the fun photos of the Daniels in our studio. You can see them on our Instagram at Death, Sex, Money. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. Thank you to Lynn Meissner in Chicago, Illinois, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. Join Lynn and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. One other way the Daniels bring camp counselor energy to their projects is how they treat their filmmaking crew. Like for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, they reversed the regular order of the credits and put the names of production assistants at the very top.
We were like, oh, that sounds fun. And we looked into it and there's no like union requirement. So like the end scroll of our movie, like we put the PAs up there. And someone came up to me after a screening a few weeks ago and started crying because it meant so much to her. And she was like, I came up as a PA and I saw the names come up in the end credits. And she like cried then and then cried again talking about it.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.